Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
So, Chris, great to see you again. I'm sure you got some great topics lined up for us, but before we jump into them, have you been watching any of the Winter Olympics?
To be honest, no. The only thing I've seen was Lindsey Vonn's crash where she broke her leg, which is related to our first topic, by the way.
Is it really?
Yes. We're going to talk about why does God permit animal pain?
Okay. Well, to jump into it, that's a good segue.
The St. Paul Center asks, why would a good God allow an injured fawn to lie trapped for 2 weeks under a fallen tree in excruciating pain before a predator finally comes along and eats it? So it brings up the question of the problem of animal pain versus human pain.
Okay. What is this institute that you're talking about?
The St. Paul Center.
Where is that?
Don't know, but they wrote an article that was linked on New Advent.
Okay.
The website that I go to.
Yep.
So C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Problem of Pain, which I think you've read.
I have not. I've read excerpts from it, but okay. I haven't read the entire book.
So he said that the problem of animal suffering is appalling, not because the animals are so numerous and that there is so much suffering, but because the Christian explanation of human pain cannot be extended to animal pain.
That's right.
So far as we know, beasts are incapable either of sin or virtue. Therefore, they can neither deserve pain nor be improved by it.
And they can't find a purpose in their pain as we can as humans.
Exactly. So when humans suffer, we trust that God is using our pain for some greater good if we allow him to use that pain for that purpose. So humans also have the consolation of knowing that God has actually entered into our pain in the form of his son, Jesus, who lived a human existence and experienced all of the things we do, including pain. But when it comes to the animal kingdom, no consolation like that exists. So just first off, how do we explain the vast and varied amount of animal pain that exists in the world?
Mm-hmm. Gosh, you know, Chris, as you're talking about this, I was thinking back to my days growing up in northern Iowa. Both my grandparents are farmers, and we were surrounded by farm animals all the time. And, you know, have to slaughter animals. And one of the realities of modern life is that most people do not grow up around animals or in nature. And so they lose contact with the reality of suffering that exists in creation all around us all the time. And so when we do, the modern person who lives in a city encounters a pet that's suffering or something like that. It just kind of, they haven't had to deal with that throughout their life growing up. And so they're less prepared for it. But I think those who have grown up more in touch with creation and more in touch with this reality of animals suffering realize that there's also a purpose that God has put in creation of the animals for our good. This is actually in the book of Genesis. All the other animals are created for man and for the good of man. And so when animals do suffer, I've raised rabbits. And when I had to butcher the rabbits at the end, it was really, really hard because you kind of grow attached to them. But you know, at the end, I need to kill this rabbit so that my family can eat it. It's just part of the cycle of life. So I think being in touch with the full gamut of God's creation gives a little bit more perspective on these. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I guess what you're talking about is human-inflicted animal pain, say, through animal husbandry. But the example they start with in this article is talking about, you know, the injured fawn who's, you know, seemingly unnecessarily in God's plan, lying around in pain for a couple weeks before it gets eaten. Is there any explanation for that?
So which wouldn't happen, by the way. It would actually probably only take about a day or two for it to be eaten.
Right. So one of the explanations that C.S. Lewis, or possible explanations that he posits, is that is it possibly related to the fall of angels that created the disordered universe? Because like animal pain existed before. Did animal pain exist before Adam and Eve fell?
Well, certainly not according to the Genesis creation. The disorder in creation comes about as a result of man's sin.
So there is no disorder of the universe when Lucifer fell? Because he was a part of the plan originally, right?
Of course, there's disorder in that, but that takes place, at least in the Genesis account, that takes place before the creation of the earth. Angels are pure spirits. So when did their rebellion take place? Did it come after the creation of the created world or before it? I don't know.
Well, either way, it predates original sin, regardless, yes. Right? The mm-hmm. fall of the angels. So did that, like, that brings me to the next question. Did that somehow, well, I guess it was proximate, because then you had the serpent who, right, is represented as a serpent, but obviously it's deceiving. Satan, right?
I think the disobedience of the angels predates the creation of the world and the disorder that, I mean, God created the earth.
Right.
The devil didn't create the earth. God created the earth, and he created it good, according to the Genesis account. The disorder in the created world comes from the sin of man, not from the sin of the angels. So in that respect, I think C.S. Lewis, if he's indeed, I haven't read it, if he's indeed is affirming that the angels...
No, he's positing it as an idea, as one possible explanation.
I think you'd have to discard that. From a theological perspective, I don't think it has grounds. I think that the disorder in creation comes from the sin of man.
But... there is this disorder that got started by the fall of the angels, which then gets manifested with the serpent tempting Adam and Eve.
And tempting us to distrust God. That comes from Satan, yes.
Right. So had the angels never fell, there would have been no temptation, and therefore there would have been no eating of the forbidden fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a disorder that was created by the fall of the angels.
Without a doubt.
So then it could possibly be an explanation for why this inexplicable mystery of animal pain, you know, it's just something we don't know about, but it's maybe just related to the disordered universe.
Well, indirectly. I mean, certainly disobedience introduces that disorder, that distrust of God.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. A study released by the Catholic Project on U.S. priests shows that most priests are satisfied with their ministry, but trust in bishops and major superiors is low. In addition, due to a decline in vocations, many younger priests feel at risk of burnout as they get stretched with increasing responsibilities. Priests ordained since the year 2000 were more likely to report that they were feeling overwhelmed, with about half saying that they were expected to do too many things that go beyond their calling as priests. Newer priests also reported higher levels of loneliness. So regarding trust in bishops, 52% of diocesan priests say they have confidence in their bishops, which is up from 49% in 2022, and 27% of all priests express confidence in the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops as a body. That's opposed to 22% in the survey prior to that. So let's take that last part.
So it's a positive trend here.
Positive
trend. Growth in trust. That's
right.
Great.
I'd like to talk about the last part first and the relationship with the bishops that the priests have, because this is, I think, opening up a window maybe into the mindset of a priest. So this is something I think maybe people are going to be interested in, because we don't experience this as laity. So, you know, as laity, we put this great importance of knowing that our spouse or significant other or our parents, that they care about us, right?
Right.
For a priest, does that equate to the bishop or the parish pastor, that there's this level of importance about them caring about you?
Of course. We're human beings. Priests are human beings just like everyone else. And we need to feel loved and appreciated and supported and validated in our mission. I did my doctoral research in this whole area of the relationship between the leadership of a bishop and the health of his diocese, and the trust level of priests with their bishops is an important part of that health of a diocese. And there's a number of factors that come into play here, and I'm really actually excited to hear that there's a positive trend in the rebuilding of trust, because the putting in place of the Dallas Charter back in 2002 and the sexual abuse crisis really introduced a strong factor of division between the bishop and his priests, and the emphasis on liability, and the bishops started seeing their priests as liabilities rather than as their primary supporters in carrying out the mission.
Potential liabilities,
Well, sometimes directly as liabilities, and that was reinforced at times by the legal departments of the diocese, because there were unfortunately so many cases of abuse, and there were dioceses that went bankrupt because of the actions of a very few priests. But then all priests were kind of labeled in the same way. It's like, I got to keep you at bay. So what's happened in the dynamic is, before that time, the priest always had a relationship with the bishop as a father. as they're the one who was looking out for them. The introduction of the Dallas Charter separated that, and it made it a strict legal division. And oftentimes, the bishop, as soon as a priest had a difficulty or self-reported something, the bishop would isolate him or treat the accused as guilty before proven guilty.
Right. So similar to a doctor, just, you know, CYA, basically, is their immediate response.
Mm-hmm.
Rather
CYA,
than,
what's that mean?
I'm not going to say it on radio.
But, okay.
Yeah.
Good. I love your self-restraint there. But this tendency has been going on for now over 20 years across the United States, and it diminished the trust that priests have in their bishop. And I could tell you horror stories of priests who are falsely accused, thrown under the bus by their bishop and by the chancery office, and then later, you know, finds out that it was completely false, but they've lost their reputation and they lost all trust in the
bishop. Well, it seems like maybe this Dallas Charter, you know, the result was that you approached the pastors and the priests as more of a business, you know, rather than as a family.
As a liability. Yeah, it totally. And I'm not saying that there were good things in the Dallas Charter, and I think it's very important to get the accountability and rebuild the trust with the lay people as well as in their clergy. But that oftentimes that trust between the priests and the bishops has not been so visible. Now, I think the trend is improving because many bishops are beginning to realize that they need to be closer to their priests. This was a really fascinating thing that came out in my own research, was that the larger a diocese was, the less likely it was to be healthy. And this, I think a big factor that's playing into that is the closeness and proximity the bishop can
have
with
his priest.
Right,
so you're basically saying it does matter.
Oh, that relationship completely does matter. Matters.
All right, what about this notion of loneliness? You know, I've known many families who, you know, we're all praying for our children and vocations, and if it, you know, is a calling that one of our children has, that we should be supportive of it. But mm-hmm. I've often heard the hesitation, you know, from parents to support a vocation for their children, as they're worried about them being lonely. So what is a priest's mindset regarding loneliness?
I think that it's directly correlated with the depth of their prayer life and the healthy balance in their lives. So those two elements. If your prayer life is deep, you have a relationship and intimacy with God, with Jesus Christ, with the Blessed Virgin Mary, that satisfies the deepest desires of your heart. It doesn't take away the tinges you can feel at times. Like last night, I went to a party and there were a bunch of couples there, and you feel a little like, oh, well, I don't have a spouse here. But I go home and I go to the chapel and it's like, okay, Lord, you are my portion and my cup. And so you go back and you find that satisfaction in your prayer and the union with God and in healthy community life, healthy dynamics and friendships. So that's on the one side. The second side is the healthy balance in a person's life. I think priests are part of the society in which we live. And as a society, we've seen an increase in anxiety and loneliness as people have gravitated more towards entertainment, social media, spending time in their phones, and not interacting with real human beings. So priests are subject to that as well. So in as much as they are doing whatever the culture does, they're going to experience the same side effects.
Families that might have otherwise hosted a priest for dinner, you know, mm-hmm. that you might have done in years past, you just stay home and watch Netflix instead.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that isolation on the part of priests is not healthy. That's why I see this dynamic, and that's why I'm so grateful to God that I have a community life. As a religious order of priests with the Legionaries of Christ, I mean, we have, I'm in a priest with seven other priests, a community with seven other priests, and we have prayer together, we have meals together, we do things together, we have getaway weekends together, and which we're fostering a healthy fraternity, which is really important for avoiding that loneliness and having a fulfilled life.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. From the publication First Things, in an article entitled Save the Fox, Kill the Fetus, they ask, why do sometimes vermin have more rights than babies? So the author brings up Irish politician Ruth Coppinger, who wants the Republic of Ireland to eliminate the mandatory 72-hour cooling-off period currently required before proceeding with an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
She says such a time delay does not apply to any other medical procedure and that one can get a nose job with no mandatory wait time. So why not also an abortion, since apparently, according to her, 40% of people, I guess, regret their nose jobs. Did you regret your nose job?
Chris, I didn't have a nose job. I've been this ugly my whole life.
Well, her equivalence of abortion to a nose job, I think, tells you
so
all
ridiculous.
You need to know about what her mindset is about how trivial it is to terminate, you know, a pregnancy.
Right. And that's the real problem. They're not recognizing that there is another human life in play here. It's not just the mother. There is a human life.
Well, she goes on to play the sexism card by noting that the law must assume that women are rash and emotional and don't fully think things through. And that's why they have to have this circuit breaker for abortion. So she's saying they should repeal it for that reason, that it's making these assumptions about women. At the same time that she advocates for streamlining abortion, she's an outspoken opponent of fox hunting, and she has put forward a bill to ban the practice of fox hunting in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to this country that evangelized the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Ireland, what's happened?
They've lost their Christian roots, and it's unfortunate, but you see this, and I know a number of Irish priests because the Legionaries of Christ, we had a novitiate in Ireland that started in the mid-60s, and we had a lot of men who joined the Legion at that time and became priests. They're really wonderful men, but part of the reason why they were joining the Legion is because they saw a dynamism of living out the gospel, which was slipping in the rest of society. And now what we see is that during that very same time in Irish society, there was a lot of sexual abuse. There were scandals going on that were just put under the table, now coming to light. And that distanced a lot of people from going to church. Many of the priests were preaching more of a kind of a nationalism than preaching the gospel. And that alienates people long term because they realize it's hollow. It's just political. So there's a number of factors that have played into that demise of the faith in Ireland. Part of it came through the economic boom in the 90s when people started living more of a prosperous life and thinking that they didn't need religion anymore.
That's what I think it is. It's,
certainly a factor.
When the Irish were poor and dependent on, England and, went through things like the potato famine and whatnot, they were busy churning out priests and
Turned to their faith in a deep way to survive all those things. And the Catholic faith became part of their national identity. And once they achieved some degree of freedom in the 1920s, that marriage between politics and religion is always a little bit problematic.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. In an article in the National Review entitled "The Troubling Trend of Combat Uniform Creep," the author...
What was the publication again?
National Review.
Oh, the National Review. Got it.
The author states what law enforcement wears, what law enforcement officers wear, matters. So he notes the increasing adoption of combat uniforms by ICE and Border Patrol, who look like Marines walking around Minnesota and other places. He posits that what people wear can have psychological effects. This is a well-known effect that's been talked about in sports for years, as teams that wear black are more likely to be penalized for aggressive fouls.
Interesting.
One study from years ago of more than 50,000 NHL hockey games over a 25-year period showed that teams that wore the darker colored jersey were penalized about 2 minutes more per game.
Interesting.
On the flip side, a study from 2012 compared the performance of identical tasks by people dressed in white lab coats and those dressed in their own regular clothes. Those in white coats outperformed those without. In a second experiment, one group was told its white coats were doctor's coats, and the second group was told that their coats were painter's coats. Those believing they wore doctor's coats outperformed those who believed they were wearing painter's coats by a statistically significant different margin. So he argues that dressing like a warrior will cause one to fight for a side, as opposed to police who, while willing to inflict violence, are operating on behalf of the law and not a side. So I have to say, I kind of agree with the premise. What do you think?
I think there's a lot to it. And it's a really fascinating idea for maybe addressing some of the violence that's going on through all of these activities that are going on. Maybe we should put, instead of combat uniforms, put white lab coats on all the ICE officers that are going out into these cities.
No, seriously. Interesting. Seriously, though, but they don't necessarily need to wear, you know, armor, body armor and camo, do they?
Well, I don't think they're wearing camo, are they?
Yeah, they're wearing camo. Black. Well, they're wearing the green colored
kind of khaki.
Yeah, it's khaki. You know, it looks like a military uniform.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, maybe it would be different if they were in something that more closely approximated a police officer's uniform.
Sure.
So,
well, some police officers' uniforms start looking pretty tactical too. I was just noting yesterday, I was with another priest in the car, and we were driving somewhere, and there was a police officer who was directing traffic outside of a school. And I just noticed, wow, they're carrying a lot of stuff on their belt these days. He had his pistol, and he had a radio, and he had a couple other gadgets. Yeah, and
his taser,
yeah,
his flashlight,
big belt,
his mace.
Yeah. So there might be something to that. I think it's an interesting idea to maybe revisit the uniforms that officers wear.
Yeah, well, I live in the city of Dunwoody, and I distinctly recall when they incorporated, which was only probably 15 years ago, maybe a little longer ago than that, that they used drug seizure money to purchase an armored vehicle that looked like a tank.
Mm.
Okay.
Wow.
And it, you know, caused a big stink about the militarization, you know, of the local police. And I'm like, what the heck does the city of Dunwoody need a tank for?
Right.
Right.
Well, because they like toys. Two of my brothers were police officers. One previously was a police officer in Buford. And I have another brother who just recently went through the police academy and became a police officer at the age of 42 or something like that. So I know my brothers, and they like toys. So police officers, a lot of them are ex-military. They've played with a lot of big toys like this before. And so they got a unlimited budget. They're going to get more toys that they can play with, even if it's not practical and they can't really use it.
Well, toys or not, I do like this idea that, you know, police officers are, you know, obeying their duty to protect and enforce the laws versus fighting for a side.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction. And I think that helping to reinforce that mentality of, we are here to serve, we're here to keep the peace, we're here to protect our citizens, really very important for a police officer.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Florida couple Stephen Mills and Tiffany Score gave birth to a baby girl in December that was conceived using in vitro fertilization. But when the couple, who were both white, gave birth to a baby who clearly is not, they ordered a genetic test to prove whether the girl was theirs or not, and sure enough, it wasn't.
Hmm. They filed, big surprise, right?
Right. So they filed a lawsuit on January 22nd against the clinic they used for IVF. They claim that they would be thrilled to raise this child, but they're concerned that someone could show up at any time and claim, you know, the baby, because
sure,
it's not theirs.
Right.
So this is obviously not something you plan for when you do IVF. And, you know, I wonder how many times this has happened before. I never really thought about this as one of the dangers of IVF. But
right.
Yeah. Thoughts?
It clearly is. And this is just one of many reasons why the Catholic Church does not like the idea of IVF clinics, because they are predicated on, you know, preying upon people who really, really, really want a child and then getting a lot of money out of that process. There are ethical ways to help couples to get pregnant, and IVF is not one of them. So there's very problematic elements that come into play.
Well, it brings to mind the old joke of three guys, an Italian, an Irishman, and an African, were waiting in a delivery room for news on their respective babies.
Mm-hmm.
When the doctor comes out and says, "Fellas, there seems to be a mix-up, and we're going to need each one of you to go back individually and identify your baby." All of a sudden, the Italian guy jumps up and runs back to the delivery area and comes walking out with a black baby. The doc says, "Sir, that is clearly not your baby, so what gives?" The Italian replies, "I'm not taking any chances of having to raise an Irish hellion."
Oh, boy. Chris, your dad must have told you that joke.
Indeed.
Oh, too funny.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. In a mea culpa, the New York Times editorial board has changed its tune on marijuana. This week they said, quote, in our editorials, we described marijuana addiction and dependence as relatively minor problems. Many advocates went further and claimed that marijuana was a harmless drug that might even bring net health benefits by legalizing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that legalization might not lead to greater use, but less. So it's now clear that many of these predictions are wrong. Legalization has led to much more use. Surveys suggest that 18 million people in the U.S. have used marijuana almost daily, or at least five times a week in recent years.
Right.
That's up from 6 million. So 18 million now, 6 million
Triple.
In 2012,
mm-hmm.
and less than 1 million in 1992.
Wow.
More Americans now use marijuana daily than alcohol. So
seriously?
The times, yeah.
That's wild.
More Americans use marijuana.
And you can smell it everywhere you go.
Right. The Times board concluded that the answer was a new federal tax on marijuana. So, yes, if you tax something, you get less of it, but they seem to be missing the point.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I think the more and more studies are coming out with some of the negative long-term effects of marijuana. I've seen it in some of the young people that I've worked with who have developed problems, mental health issues at a much deeper, higher incident level and deeper problems. And once they stop the marijuana, some of those side effects go away, but not completely. There's residual effects throughout a person's life. And some of the studies showing the increased level of schizophrenia, very significant. So I think there's enough reasons why as a society we should be a lot more circumspect about this and stop the trend of legalizing it. And let's say, what can we do to curtail this usage.
Well, and it's, shocking to me the Times, is willing to reverse their position because it seems like so many...
To their credit, that's a good thing.
To their credit, absolutely, yeah. Right? Because so many other newspapers, editorial boards just take an ideological stance that they're, going to go with
right.
regardless of the evidence otherwise because it, mm-hmm. Supports a particular political party.
Sure. Yeah.
And in this case, they, to their credit, as you say, they looked at the data and they're saying maybe it was wrong. I don't like their mm-hmm. solution, though.
No, the solution, it's one solution among many other things, but I think we got to dig a little bit deeper when it comes to actual solutions for the problem.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires. Navigating News with Faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.